gnats and ticks, mosquitoes. What's up with them? Do they have a purpose beyond just annoying
us? Right. So from our point of view, I'd say their only purpose is to annoy us. They are an important part for food webs. You know, like bats and other insects will eat mosquitoes. Male mosquitoes actually pollinate. So only female mosquitoes bite us because they need the blood to make eggs. The better option is really to try to reduce their breeding habitat. They can reproduce in a tiny amount of water, and they can do it quickly. Right. And so there's a type of bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short, and it only affects the larvae of flies, and mosquitoes are a type of fly, and they're the mosquito dunks. And you can throw them out into a pond, and they release the bacteria, and it means that when the mosquito lays eggs there, the eggs don't develop. A bucket of death.
A term for today.
Yeah.
A bucket of death. Welcome to the fifth episode of Desert Diaries. I'm your host, Daniel Carey Whalen, the director of the Centennial Museum in Chihuahuan Desert Gardens here on the campus of the University of Texas at El Paso. I'm with my guest again, Dr. Kevin Floyd, botanical curator of the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. How are you doing, Kevin?
Doing good. Really enjoying these conversations. You're covering a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited as well. We are covering a lot of good stuff. I know we talked about the birds a couple episodes ago, and now we're talking about the bees. So, you know, for all you parents out there, if you need to cover your kids' ears, we're talking about insects this week, which, you know, insects, bugs. Actually, I think I have a lead-off question of, you know, what are arachnids, right? Like, what? I always get confused as a non-scientist. What are these words? What's the biggest umbrella? Is insect kind of the biggest umbrella? Bugs?
So certainly in just sort of general use, bugs is the umbrella term that if you tell someone you've seen a bug, it could be a spider, an insect, anything, a scorpion. Insects and arachnids are different. So arachnids are, they're all arthropods. So that's the big group that includes all of these. And, you know, one branch of that are the insects. A different branch include the arachnids, which are the, you know, spiders and scorpions and things like that. And so when we're talking about, and within insects, there's actually a group that are called the true bugs. And so that's a whole different group, sort of a subgroup within that. So if you find an entomologist, someone who studies insects, and you say, I saw a bug, they'd be like, oh, order Hemipteran, how wonderful. But of course, you're like, I saw daddy long legs. Right. Look at that bug. So there's plenty of online battles that can be had over the terminology. So we certainly, you know, try to be precise about stuff when we're talking to people at the museum, or if we're posting on our social media through the museum and gardens. I definitely try to make sure that we are correct but understandable to the general public.
Today's conversation, essentially things that have multiple legs, crawl around, that might bug you. We're talking about all of them here today, and we're it's about life in the Chihuahuan Desert. So, what are some of the insects that we find in our desert area, and what makes them unique?
There's probably tens of thousands, and so we're not going to go through all of them by right. by any means. So don't worry. Some of the big groups that I think people are most interested in, so pollinators, that's one of the big classes. And that's what got me into, you know, insects and insects into plants. So pollinators, they're anything that transfers pollen from one plant to another, basically help with plant reproduction. And so the ones that we think about the most, I think most people know bees are pollinators, butterflies are pollinators, moths are pollinators, but also beetles and wasps and flies, those can all be pollinators as well. And they're really important. They're one of the things we think about the most because pollination is such an important part of human existence. Yeah. So much of the food that we eat you know, sip your coffee. That's from pollinators. Have a piece of chocolate. That's from pollinators. Eat some almonds. That's from pollinators. Have an apple. That's from pollinators. And yeah. So, you know, so much of the food that we eat really relies on having pollinators there to make it. And yeah, so, sure. And so there's a lot of interest in pollination because of the food and the agricultural point of view. And so the other thing that people love about pollinators is they're really pretty. So, I mean, who doesn't love a butterfly? And yeah, so those yeah. Pollinators are in areas that people sort of have an affinity for. Another group, and we can certainly talk more about these groups going forward, but there's also, you know, predatory insects. And one of the big players of those are wasps. And like I mentioned, some are pollinators, but, you know, a lot of times they're out getting insects and spiders and things like that. And they use that to raise their young. And so most of the wasps, it's really, I mean, it's, they're so metal. Like, nature is so metal because there's like tarantula hawks. It's a wasp that a lot of people are familiar with. The big, beautiful. Big black, scary looking. They have a really painful sting apparently, but they're also very reluctant to sting people. But what they use that big stinger for is to sting a tarantula. Yes. And they paralyze the tarantula. And then they drag it back to their nest, paralyzed. They lay their eggs on it, and they close up the nest. And so when those eggs hatch, they eat the paralyzed spider.
Right. That's still alive.
That's still alive and can't do anything. And, you know, the larvae eat the caterpillar, they pupate, and then they emerge as adult wasps.
Yes.
And that's the tarantula hawk. There's a lot of other spider hawks and a lot of other things that do the sort of you know, nightmare situation of being paralyzed and eaten alive.
I remember learning that in like a biology class in probably high school or something.
It sticks with you.
Yeah, right. It's pretty messed up, right? Yeah. Oh, this is, you know, the beauty of nature being eaten from the inside. But when I first moved here, I was amazed that I'd heard about it, and then I found out it was in this region, and they're such a beautiful bug. I mean, they're really kind of effervescent. They shimmer.
They're black, but they have kind of a blue tinge if you see them in the right light, and like golden wings.
And I remember my kids when they were younger, they were into this some YouTuber who was like being stung by, he would sting himself with all of the crazy, like all of the most horrific stinging animals, and he would kind of rate it. How painful was it?
Yeah, I think that's a different guy. There's a guy, I think his name is Justin Schmidt, and he was an entomologist, I believe in Arizona, and he had the Schmidt Pain Index, and he stung himself with all sorts of different things on different body parts, including the ones that you would think of that you would not want to be stung on, and would rank things both on like what part of the body is most sensitive, but also the level of sting. Oh, right. And he would describe them in great terminology. I think some he described as like a light tingle, like, you know, reminiscent of a pop rock in your mouth. And others are like, all I could do was lie down and pray for death. So there's definitely a wide range of venom out there.
That guy sounds a little more scientific than the ones my kids were watching, who are kind of flailing around in their backyard. Definitely. Like, would you call them predatory? So these are bugs that are eating other bugs. I think of spiders, right? They're catching them in their web, and they're carnivorous.
So there's predators, and there's also parasitoids. And the spider I was describing, the tarantula hawk, that's more of a parasitoid. So it doesn't kill the host and eat it. It paralyzes or lays its eggs on that. The other one you might see with some of the wasps, if you're a gardener and you have tomato hornworms, they're the big, you know, big green worms, or maybe 3 or 4 inches long. They're the larvae of the moth that we see, the night flying sphinx moth. That's another topic we can talk about, but there's these wasps that are parasitic, and they lay their eggs in the alive caterpillar, and then you can sometimes see it because the caterpillar looks like it's covered in a bunch of white bumps, and those are the I think they're the pupae of the wasps. And so that it basically is this walking host where all these wasps are developing, and it eventually dies while producing a bunch of additional wasp babies. So in the gardening world, that's what we call a beneficial insect, because it's something that's doing, you know, a behavior that actually helps us in our desire, which is to not have as many, you know, caterpillars eating our tomatoes. And it keeps that wasp population doing well.
Wow. Yeah. No, we're totally going into the metamorphosis between what are they called?
There's two different types of metamorphosis. The one that you know butterflies do, there's
right.
an egg.
Yeah.
The egg hatches. It's a larvae or a caterpillar. It grows, eats, and does all that stuff, and then it goes through
a very hungry caterpillar.
Right, and then it goes through a chrysalis stage, and then or a pupa stage, and then it emerges as an adult. And often the adult looks so different than the caterpillar, which you know is a big issue when we talk about butterflies in particular, because their babies are caterpillars, and a lot of times caterpillars are eating the plants that we want to be growing, and so we kill the caterpillar and then turn around and wonder where are all the butterflies.
Right,
and it's like, well, you killed their babies, so of course they're not going to be around. So we definitely try to educate people when we do classes at the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens here on campus. We'll tell people, you know, you got to let something, there has to be insect damage. If you want to have butterflies, if you want to have bees, you want to have these things, something's going to have to eat, they need to eat something. And so you have to accept some of that damage to be able to have the adults. And you can certainly, if it's a crop plant, you're trying to grow tomatoes, I'm not saying like let all your tomatoes be decimated, but what are the other plants that you can allow some sort of, you know, insect damage on so that we can have the full like life cycle of those insects?
Okay, what are some of the other kind of categories of insects that are in this area?
One of the other big groups are decomposers or detritivores. So those are the insects that you typically find if you're, you know, gardening, digging around in the soil. See, you know, could be caterpillars. And a lot of these are arthropods, but not insects. So things like pill bugs. So those are a different group, but important detritivores, springtails and, you know, centipedes, again, different, not insects, but really important members of that sort of soil food web. And they're helping with the decomposition. So, you know, when plants lose leaves, when you have bark that falls off a tree or, a dead animal or poop, one of our favorite things to talk about here on the podcast, it's insects and other, invertebrates that are breaking that down. And if you don't have that, then we have this buildup of waste. We're not completing the cycle of that organic matter breaking down into its components that can then be taken up by plants to use again. So, you know, like composting, most of the time we don't think about it, but composting is basically a bacterial and insect process. So, if you have a compost pile, you have to keep it wet because you need to have an environment that living things can survive in to do that decomposition.
I almost never think, even though I'm a gardener and I occasionally see, when I'm digging in the dirt, I don't see a lot of those bugs, but I very rarely think of those types because I just think, being from the Midwest, other places, wetter places, like you turn over a rock and roly-polies, there's all sorts of those types.
Yeah.
It's just, like you said, it's relationship with water.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of water around here, and so I often don't even think of those bugs because I don't see them around.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're definitely, they like these little microclimates, these little areas where, under a rock, the rock protects the moisture that is there from evaporating out.
Yeah.
And so there's different things that are living under rocks or under bushes or in leaf litter that you won't see if you just, are out in the middle of an open space and it's just hot sand. You won't see as many of those cool soil invertebrates.
Well, I've changed my gardening practices since we started working together. And
yeah.
I know it's the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens mission. And to, keep people to keep their leaf litter that don't just completely clean, especially in the wintertime, right? Not to just clean out your garden, make it look immaculate. That leaving it all there is going to create little microclimates for bugs.
Yeah, so there's a whole campaign now that, like you said, it's really, you know, nationwide, probably worldwide, that, you know, the catchphrase is leave the leaves. And so, you know, the leaves have so many benefits that, you know, they keep more moisture. So there's, you know, these invertebrates that are living in that area. A lot of really cool insects will overwinter in leaf piles or in the leaf litter. So, you know, some of the caterpillars, their pupal phase. So, you know, that's where the moths and butterflies are going to come from, is that leaf litter. But it's also really important for building the soil. So, again, thinking from the gardener point of view, that organic matter in those leaves, that improves the quality of your soil. And if what people do is they rake them up or leaf blow them up and they bag them and take them to the dump, those leaves aren't going to do anything for their yard, and then they're going to have to turn around and buy, you know, fertilizer from the store or compost from the store, and, you know, you could just use your leaves to do that whole process. And so it's impressive. Some of the soil, you know, here in the gardens where we leave the leaves a little bit, the soil has gotten a lot better, and you can see more organic matter. And so it's a good campaign. It's one of those things that I feel like is a great, like, just be lazy. Like, it's this is your excuse to spend your weekends watching football, eating apple pie, you know, doing whatever you want, and not out there picking up every single leaf that you see on the ground. And you can tell people, or like, your yard's a mess. I'm like, it's for the bugs. I'm doing it. It's for the bugs.
For the environment. Yeah. For the ecosystem. I love it. Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay. So you heard it here. You can be lazy on the weekends.
Yeah. It's actually better. You're doing a good cause. You can celebrate your laziness.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we kind of touched upon with the pollinators, made me think of migration. You know, we talked about birds, migration, but what are some of the animals or insects that are migrating? Is it similar reasons to the birds? Why are insects migrating?
Insects in general don't migrate as much as we would think of with birds. A lot of times they'll deal with winter conditions by, you know, either overwintering in the ground in some sort of essentially a hibernation stage or a diapause, or it's their babies that are overwintering and the adults don't live very long and they die out. But there are some that migrate. I think probably the example that most people think of is the monarch butterfly. We're sort of at the in between the two ranges. There's a population that's on the West Coast that spends the winters in sort of the coastal California area. And then there's the population that spends the winters in Mexico, in the highlands in Mexico. And that's the population that covers the entire, basically everything east of the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah,
and
right.
So
yeah.
We do see them here.
Flyway.
Exactly. And they're this really cool migratory pattern where they're a multi-generational migration. And so when the adults leave the mountains in Mexico, they go, I'm not sure how far, they go up to, like, you know, the Gulf Coast area, and then they reproduce, they make, you know, they eat milkweed, they lay eggs, and then the adults die, and then those caterpillars metamorphose, and they become adults, and they go a little bit further, and then they do the same thing. And I think it's four generations total. I think it's three going north, and then that last northern population is the one that migrates all the way down south in one fell swoop. And so there's a lot of, you know, work. And again, it's like with the birds. If there's more resources in the northern environments because of the longer day length in the summer, and so it's a good place to make babies and reproduce. But then it gets really cold, and if you're an insect, that's not great. And so they then can migrate further. They migrate back south to be able to overwinter and then do it all again. And so again, here, the butterfly we see the most is a cousin of theirs called the queen butterfly.
Okay.
And it's a little bit, the monarch is a really bright orange. The queen is more of a brownish orange.
Okay.
The monarch is a little bit bigger. It has black lines, that sort of stained glass look to it. And we do see them. I've seen a few of them this fall. It's definitely not, you know, they do come through, but not in the same numbers that we see with queens. So most of the time if someone says, I saw 20 monarchs in my yard, I'm like, did you really? Like, what?
Right.
Tell me what color those were. Maybe they were. Maybe you got lucky and had this, like, migratory surge come through. But more than likely, those were queens.
Right, Right. Okay. So that's, I was just thinking, I saw a ton in the garden this fall, and it's probably queens.
Yeah, probably the queens.
Yeah.
And then there are some other things. I know dragonflies, some populations of dragonflies will migrate. Okay. Ladybug beetles or ladybugs, they don't do long migration, but they kind of can move up and down elevation a little bit, so up and down a mountain range.
Okay.
So there are some that do migrate, and it's things that typically have a longer adult phase than, you know, a lot of the insects that the adults are alive for a season at the most.
Yeah, right. I forget about that they have such a short lifespan. They're really, you know, born and reproduce and die fairly quickly.
Yeah, or at least the adult phase is short-lived. And some of them, I mean, think about the cicada. There was the big, you know, 17-year cicada emergence this year in the East Coast. Those insects, they spend 17 years of their life underground gaining energy, and then they go through metamorphosis, and the adults are alive for a few weeks probably, and then they
make
scream.
A lot of noise.
They scream, they reproduce, and then they get eaten by a bird or a dog, and that's their life. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, what about, I have been thinking, there's like, I guess we would call them nuisance bugs, but, you know, I just think, like, what is their purpose other than to annoy us? You know, gnats, and I mean, we don't have a lot of ticks around here, but, you know, in the Midwest definitely did, but gnats and ticks, mosquitoes, like, what's up with them? Do they have a purpose rather than annoying us?
So
beyond just annoying
us. Right. So from our point of view, I'd say their only purpose is to annoy us. They are an important part for food webs. So, you know, like bats and other insects will eat mosquitoes. Male mosquitoes actually pollinate. So they're, you know, the males, so only female mosquitoes bite us because they need the blood to make eggs. Males don't do that. So male mosquitoes won't bother you, but they do pollinate. So they'll go to flowers to get nectar for energy. So they can be important for that. But often a lot of it, you just sort of have to take off the human glasses, and their purpose is to survive and reproduce.
Right.
And there is this area that basically there was open in evolution, and they evolved to get some blood, which is nice, you know, some nutrients and reproduce. And that's what they do. And so it may not be great for us. I mean, mosquitoes in particular carry a lot of diseases because it's, you know, it's all these bloodborne pathogens.
Right.
They're sucking blood up from one person or one animal and putting them into another. So West Nile virus, Zika, like there's any number.
There's
a bunch of mosquito-borne diseases.
Yeah.
I think there's some statistic that like mosquitoes are responsible for more deaths in the world than like all other causes combined. So that, you know, mosquito control is definitely an important piece. But one of the challenges is, you know, if you do mosquito fogging or you're doing things like that in your yard, they're not selective. You're not just killing mosquitoes, you're killing everything.
Right.
And so the better option is really to try to reduce their breeding habitat. So they can reproduce in a tiny amount of water, and they can do it quickly.
Right.
And so it's not having, you know, a puddle in your yard necessarily. It's having a piece of garbage. It's having, you know, a wrapper of some sort that's able to collect water, and as long as it doesn't dry out in 3 or 4 days, that can be a place for them to produce more babies. Dog bowls, like any source of water, pots, if you have the little saucers underneath them to catch the water, those can be mosquito breeding habitat. But so one of the really cool things, it's a bucket of death is the term.
All right.
Yeah. And so
a term for today.
Yeah.
Bucket of death.
And so there's a type of bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short, and it only affects the larvae of flies, and mosquitoes are a type of fly.
Okay.
And they're the mosquito dunks. So you might have seen them at the store. They're little, you know, look like donuts almost, and you can throw them out into a pond, and they release the bacteria. And it means that when the mosquito lays eggs there, the eggs don't develop. And so the mosquitoes, it doesn't kill the adults, so the adults will still be around. But like we said, adults don't live very long. Right. So if we can make all the sources of water essentially non-breeding areas, the females will lay eggs there, and then the eggs don't make it, and then you don't have as many mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And so the bucket of death is you take a 5-gallon bucket, you fill it up, you know, 3/4 with water, put a mosquito dunk or even like a quarter of a mosquito dunk in it, add some grass clippings or something, because as they break down, they produce carbon dioxide, which is what mosquitoes are attracted to. That's why they, you know, that's how they sense us, one of the ways. And so you're creating this like CO2, you know, attractant, and they lay their eggs, and then those eggs don't develop because of the BT. And so it's a way to help keep that population from growing to where, and not having to spray. It's, again, specific only to the mosquitoes or other flies that are in that area. So it's a really nice way to not have to deal with mosquitoes. And I mean, I'm an insect lover. I hate mosquitoes. I itch for days afterwards. So I'm always covered up. You know, I'm always wearing long sleeve shirts and hats and all of that to have less surface area for them to get me.
Yes.
People love having me outside because I get all the mosquitoes and then they're fine. I'm the attractant for that.
Right.
But yeah, so these buckets of death can be a good way to try to keep the populations down, at least.
Okay, that's good. Good to know. Yeah, God, but I always tell my wife she gets bit more because she's so sweet, but I think it's just she's emitting more carbon dioxide, maybe.
Too much exhalation, and I think there are other chemicals in there too. Because I know certainly some people are more attractive to them than others. And you always hear it's this chemical. They eat, you know, eat onions and you're fine or something, right?
Like there's different garlic. That was always whenever we went camping in the Boy Scouts, that was it. Eat garlic and you're not going to get bit as much. That's good to know. It's nice to know that the males are pollinators. Mm-hmm. I can feel a little bit better about them. I think thank goodness we don't have a lot of those type of bugs or nuisance bugs that we have that are in other parts of the country. I
mean, we don't have as much of that issue. We do have kissing bugs here, which is another one that can spread the bacteria or protozoan, I think, that causes Chagas disease.
Oh, yeah.
And so those are around and can get people. They're not as prevalent by any means as some of these others, and they like to be in sort of dark areas, and so, and again, more nocturnal, so they can get you at night and things like that. So there are plenty of things that can be problematic, but not anywhere in the numbers that more tropical or wetter areas get.
When we first moved here, I remember people were saying, "Oh, look out for the scorpions." That, you know, you're going to see a lot of scorpions. I can definitely count on one hand. I've been here for 12 years, haven't seen a lot, but are we just lucky? People say a lot of times it's in newer developments and in newer homes that they kind of, you know, went out and scraped the landscape out and built
new homes. Where the scorpions live,
So
it's like you walk into the scorpion's house and then you wonder why there's a scorpion there.
That's right.
Yeah, and they can be problematic. Luckily, I mean, their sting is defensive, so, you know, they're not out there, and they probably use it in hunting, but as far as we would be concerned, it's not something where they're chasing you down the hall trying to sting you. I think a lot of times what happens is they'll be in a shoe or in something like that, and so when you, or you get out, you know, get up in the middle of the night and accidentally step on one, so that can be the issue. They're not too hard to move. You can put a cup over them and slide a piece of paper underneath and take them and relocate them outside. So they're pretty cool to see. I kind of and they glow in the dark. I don't know if you knew that. So under black lights, they actually fluoresce. So that's one of the ways I know some of the groups that do night tours. So Paul Heider, who's involved in a lot of the environmental groups, will lead night hikes in the Franklins, and they take the black light out, and it's like little glowy scorpions all over the place.
Yeah. I've always wanted to go on those, and always missed the opportunity. Yeah. But I've heard about them. It's pretty cool. Well, let's go back to bees. We talked about pollinators, bees being one of them. What's a native bee and a non-native bee? What's the difference between The two.
So the bee that, you know, if you just say think of a bee, what you're going to think of is a honeybee. It's the one that is the most important agricultural bee. It's the one that we get honey from and beeswax and things like that. And that is a non-native bee. So it's native to Europe and Africa. They were brought over for basically human purposes. I think initially it was for the beeswax more than anything. So,
candles.
Right. So brought over when there wasn't electricity. And so the beeswax was really important. Obviously, honey has been an important part of that as well. And so it's an important sugar source. And nowadays, the most important thing they do is their pollination services.
Right.
Honeybees have this really, at least for most bees, it's a unique life history where they have these hives and these big populations. And so a single hive can have 10,000, 20,000 workers, and they're all in this confined area. So for agriculture, it works great because you can basically close the box, stick them on the back of a truck and drive them where you need pollination to occur. And so there's bees that travel. I mean, they're better traveled than most people. They go from California for almond pollination in like February, and then they go up to Oregon and they do the apples and the cherries and Washington, and then they maybe go over to Wisconsin, and then they get to spend their, a lot of them overwinter in the Gulf states where it's a little bit warmer and there's, you know, more resources for them. And it's a, you know, millions of dollars industry, and there's cases of hives getting stolen and, you know, a bunch of stuff with that, and it's worth a lot of money. And so they're a really important animal. They're an important insect, but they're so different from our native bees. So in North America, we've got around 4,000 species of native bees.
Wow.
And that diversity is centered in the desert, which you wouldn't think. You're like, there's no food for them, but there's enough food, and it's sort of specialize in these different areas that have allowed for bees to specialize on these different types of resources. So in New Mexico, I think the number is around 500 species of native bees.
Wow.
Arizona, it's probably close to 800 or more. We don't really know how many are here. We've been doing work to try to document what the native bees are in the El Paso area. And, you know, it's probably, you know, hundreds of native bees.
Yeah.
Most of our native bees are solitary, so they don't have hives, they don't have queens, they don't have workers, they don't have any of that stuff. Most of them are solitary, so it's a female that's out gathering pollen, and the pollen is what they use to feed their babies. Like we talked about with wasps and spiders, that's the protein.
Sure.
Bees are basically vegetarian wasps, so they're collecting pollen as that fat and protein source, mixing it with some nectar, and then they make a little pollen loaf, so a little ball of pollen and nectar, and they lay an egg on it, and then they section that off. It's a little individual chamber, and then they do the next chamber.
Okay.
And it's just that single female doing all the work herself. And so one of the things that's nice about that is that they're not very aggressive. They, you know, they don't, their main thing is to collect the food, lay the eggs, avoid getting eaten. And so you can get really close to them and check them out, and they really either just fly away or they ignore you.
Okay.
And they're beautiful. I mean, there's bright green bees, there's black and white stripes, there's sort of fuzzy orange ones, the male carpenter bees. So a lot of people know carpenter bees, which are the big black ones.
Right.
The male of one of the species we have here is tan. It's like a teddy bear.
Really?
And with green eyes, they're really pretty.
Wow.
And males don't sting. So the females, the sting is a modified ovipositor or egg-laying organ. So the females can sting, the males can't. And so if you see a big orange, you know, all orange tan bee, you can take a look at it and get as close as you want, and it can't really do anything. It can bite you, I guess, but doesn't, you know, only if you're grabbing it. So our native bees are just really important. They're also pollinators. They're important pollinators, both of our native plants as well as crops. And we really don't know what's going on in terms of their status because people haven't done the work. They're so hard to monitor. Like, how do you tell how many bees are out there? And typically we figure stuff out by marking and releasing. And how do you mark and release a bee that's, you know, smaller, like a grain of rice? There's some that are tiny. So we just don't really know a lot about what's going on. But they're really, again, they're a really cool species. They're cute, I think. and really worth understanding and studying and knowing that we've got a ton of diversity here. So the Chihuahuan Desert is a place that has a lot of native bee diversity.
Can't think of any specific plant that I see them on. Different times of year, right? I feel like the spring, mm-hmm. I saw just tons and tons of bees just all over a plant, and they were just doing their own thing. I was standing right there looking at it. They weren't bothered by me at all.
And it's interesting because they'll come out, different bees come out at different times of the year. So there's one that's called a mason bee that's actually like a bright metallic blue, and it's an early spring bee. So it comes out in maybe March, April. Okay. And so it's really important that there's food sources for them. And so for us, they really like the Mexican red buds that we have. Okay, that's a small tree that flowers early with pink flowers.
Oh, beautiful.
Agarita, which is a spiny plant, but it has yellow flowers. Again, an early spring bloomer. The Mexican poppies. Early spring bloomers that are important for that. And then towards the end of the season, you know, those are all gone. Like those bees, their life cycle, they're out for that spring period. They reproduce, they lay eggs, and then the adults die. And then those eggs are waiting for next year, the larvae are. Right. And then there's some bees that come out later in the year. So they're sort of our midsummer, our fall bees. And same thing, we have to make sure there's food for them. So, you know, when we talk about how do we help to protect pollinators and turn our yards into pollinator habitat, you have to think for the entire season. You have to have, you know, it's not just roses in the middle of the summer. You've got to have your early spring, your mid-spring, summer, fall, basically the whole season worth of food for them.
And we, I think as humans, we appreciate it more, right? Oh, this thing's blooming in the spring and this thing's blooming in the fall. I like to try to have things blooming all year round personally, but knowing that I'm helping the bees, that's a extra bonus.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the great thing in El Paso, other than maybe, you know, January, like there's stuff flowering just about year round. Right. So you can really, you know, enjoy that full year worth of color.
Just seems like an area ripe for research, and a lot of the natural world is just very ripe for research. It's amazing how much we don't know.
Yeah, insects in particular, and part of it is just they're so hard to study. There's so many of them. They're small. Right. They can take a decent amount of expertise to be able to identify. But we have some great entomologists here at UTEP, and they're working on moths. There is one. Bill McKay, who is a world-class expert on ants, and there's something like 500,000 ant specimens at the biodiversity collections in the biology building.
We did the ant exhibit a couple years ago. Yeah.
And just, again, ton of diversity and a really important thing that most people don't ever think about. Brett Seymour is a relatively new faculty member who's doing work on moths particularly and light pollution with moths. Right. And, you know, we light up the night sky, and how is that impacting all of our nocturnal insects and animals? And so he's doing a lot of work trying to figure out, you know, what are the impacts, but also are there ways of developing lights or ways of shielding lights that does a better job of, you know, allowing the wildlife to still survive. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of really great opportunities. And that's, I mean, bugs are difficult, insects are difficult, but on the other hand, they're everywhere. So, you know, I was doing work for about 6 years of just studying the bees here on campus and had a bunch of undergrads. It was great because you could, you know, leave class, go study insects, go have lunch, go to your afternoon class.
Right.
And you don't have to, you know, drive to the field. You don't have to fly to South America. And I mean, I would love to fly to South America, right?
Yeah.
But it's just a really great way for people to get some research experience as well as exposure to the natural world.
Yeah. Well, and that's how you and I met.
Yeah.
Just pan trapping in in the garden. So hopefully we'll inspire some future entomologists here.
I mean, check them, just sit in front of a plant. My neighbors must think I'm crazy because I'm out in my front yard staring at plants, like sitting on the ground, staring at a flower. But there's so much diversity. And again, just living in a suburb in El Paso, I have a bunch of different species of bees and butterflies and moths and wasps and flies and just all that just from having, you know, a yard that has native plants in it and not spraying insecticides.
I mean, we talk about enjoying them, and but they're also they're in decline, right?
Yeah.
So in general, not just here in the desert or in El Paso, but, you know, we're this is a a problem everywhere. So why? What are some of the theories on why insects are in decline?
Yeah, there have been some pretty shocking numbers of some of the studies that have tried looking at this. It can be tough, again, for all the reasons we said, but like monarch butterflies, which people have studied really well, their populations have plummeted. And with any of these, it's a variety of causes. Probably the biggest is habitat loss. Yeah. So we're taking, you know, areas that used to have the plants that they need, the conditions that they need, and we're turning it into agricultural fields or housing or things like that. And so that just decreases the number that are available. The other sort of related to that are the use of insecticides. So, sure. You know, modern agriculture uses a lot of chemicals to keep the crop production up. Right. And the you know, you're killing the pests, but you also kill a lot of the other things as well.
Yeah.
And then climate change is having an impact as well. So both in terms of the heat, so insects, they're cold-blooded or ectotherms. And so the temperature that depends on how much they can fly or move around is dependent on the temperature. If it gets too hot, they basically can't be out during that period. So it reduces the amount of time that they're able to be moving around. And so it's a wide variety of causes. I think, you know, some of the things, you know, obviously big picture, we need to be thinking about, you know, habitat protection, habitat restoration on a large scale, small scale in your yard, like I was mentioning, both, you know, in my house here at the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens, all of the plants that we have really support those, you know, these little pockets of habitat can help out with a lot of the insects. And just not using insecticides as much, like we talked about with the mosquito spraying, right? Just because there's mosquitoes, if you go and spray, if you're not careful about it, you're wiping out everything else at the same time.
Right, right, yeah.
And I think one of the things that is interesting, some of these declines have been tough to capture because it's happening relatively slowly, so we don't notice it on a year-to-year scale. And so the one that a lot of people talk about is the windshield effect. You know, if you think about, you know, doing road trips, you know, 20 years ago, your windshield gets covered in dead bugs, splatter, and you have to pull over and wipe the windshields and all of that. And you just don't have to do that as much anymore. There's just fewer insects out there, so you aren't seeing them as much when you're driving around.
Right. Yeah. No, I have. I've definitely noticed. I mean, still some long road trip in the summertime, I feel like there's still some, but
yeah.
But not a lot.
Yeah, and that's tough, right? Like a lot of these they're still out there,
yeah.
And they still might even be numerous, but they're not as numerous as they used to be.
Right.
And so it's a sign of some of the degradation and the declines in the environment.
Just leads to everything else, right? So the there's not enough food for bird species who are eating them, and animals are eating birds. It's the whole food web gets affected.
Some of the studies of birds, because birds, you know, they're bigger, and there's a ton of crazy bird watchers like myself who, you know, report their sightings, and some of the birds that are impacted the most, that have declined the most, are the insect-eating birds.
Yeah.
Things like swallows and flycatchers, and, you know, there's just not as much food out there for them anymore, so their populations aren't doing as well.
I'd hate to end on this grim note. Is there a insect out there that, I don't know, your favorite or...
Yeah. Well, and so certainly, you know, it is sobering, certainly, to look at the situation. But I do think that we all – it's one of the great areas that we can all make a difference in. It's something that we can control by how we garden, how we take care of our own yards. And so, you know, I really do encourage people to plant more flowers, native plants ideally, but certainly anything like that, being really careful with your use of insecticides. And we can have these little pockets and hopefully, you know, not have all these bad, sobering thoughts. But yeah, in terms of insects that I'm just always happy to see, is basically all of them. But around here, I think some of the ones I really like are the bumblebees. I think they're one we have here is called the Sonoran bumblebee. It's really the only species that we have in El Paso. So the bumblebees are black and yellow stripes. So if you see a big black bee, it's a carpenter bee. or if it's a big tan bee, it's a carpenter bee, a male. But if it's black and yellow, then it's a bumblebee and big. And they just
fuzzy.
And they're fuzzy, right? Yeah. And they're just kind of doofy. They just kind of, you know, they try to get into these flowers. Like sometimes, you know, their little legs and butt sticking out of the flower, if it's like a tubular or a trumpet-shaped flower. And it's just really, really cute to see. And they're decent numbers of them. And they're just a really, you know, they always make me smile when I see them in the world.
I love it. You know, as always, Kevin, great talking with you. We're going to wrap up this edition of Desert Diaries. Look forward to everyone joining us to celebrate life in the Chihuahuan Desert. See you next time on Desert Diaries.
Desert Diaries is recorded in the KTEP Public Media Studios and is a production of the University of Texas at El Paso Division of Marketing and Communications.
This will be fun. I don't know what the questions are. This is totally off the cuff.
Oh, you're going in blind.
I know. How exciting.
What's the truth about bugs? Tell me the truth.